The refugee crisis out of Venezuela continues to grow, and it's hitting neighboring countries hard.
Children with skin disease, losing colors and losing hair. I mean, these are the first signs of malnutrition.
Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're going to talk with WLRN reporter Tim Padgett, who returned from his trip to Cúcuta, Colombia, with an update. Plus, the Rainbow Cultural Garden in downtown Miami has shut its doors. A Miami New Times report found it didn't have a license. Even stranger, the school may have links to the NXIVM cult leader, Keith Raniere. And we're going to talk with the 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner in history, Jack Davis, about his book, The Gulf. And we're joined by the Harlem Quartet, a group devoted to spreading classical music to a more diverse audience. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The Venezuelan refugee crisis is overwhelming South American countries like Brazil and especially Colombia. That was evident last Friday when the UN had to suspend a new food stamps program for Venezuelans in the Colombian border city of Cúcuta because the crowds were simply too large and chaotic. WLRN's Tim Padgett just returned from Cúcuta, where he witnessed this growing humanitarian crisis. Tim, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you, Luis.
Remind us of the numbers and the magnitude of this crisis that you saw up close.
Well, as I saw myself, you've got about 20 to 30,000 people escaping Venezuela, coming over the border into the border Colombian city of Cúcuta every day. And up to a quarter of those people actually stay there to try to start a new life because things are so horrifically bad back in Venezuela in terms of an economic collapse that has created an humanitarian crisis where people have little, if any, food, little, if any, medicine, and other basic goods. So you have got this overwhelming wave of humanity pouring over the border into Colombia every day, and it is overwhelming that country, as is it is overwhelming some other countries, like Brazil, as you mentioned.
Now, you posted a photo on social media over the weekend of a Venezuelan refugee mother and her infant son in complete despair as they waited in line, these long, very hot lines for the food stamps. And you said that it summed up your reporting trip there.
Right. That image I took outside of one of the evangelical churches near the airport in Cúcuta, which is one of the sites being used by the UN World Food Program to distribute these, as they're called, bonos, or essentially food stamps that these Venezuelan refugees can use to get food at area supermarkets and things of that nature. And this mother, her name was Jamira, was just sitting out there under this hot, baking noontime sun in Cúcuta, Colombia. We're talking about, southeast Colombia, and her little one-year-old infant son, and they were just sitting there in this impossibly long line with hundreds, if not thousands, of other Venezuelan refugees, and she just seemed to be collapsing there, and it just seemed, as you said, to sum up both the destitution I was seeing that characterizes these Venezuelan refugees coming over, but also the sense of hopelessness. You're talking about one of the worst economic collapses in South American history, but also one of the worst refugee crises in Venezuelan history. And the ones that are coming now are in really some of the worst straits, as you can hear from this assessment in an interview that I had with a man named Ricardo Supo, who is with the World Food Program there in Cúcuta.
Now what we see is that the most recent people that are coming, they are the worst situations. And you go walking around and you're going to see children with skin disease, with blonde hair that becoming like losing colors and losing hair. And, I mean, these are the first signs of malnutrition. And you see more and more. Now it's really like the escape of the desperate.
Right, escape of the desperate. I think that sums it up. And I can vouch for what he was saying about seeing young children, Latino children who would normally have, black hair but would be brunettes. You're seeing it turn lighter, and that is one of the first signs of malnutrition.
We talked last week, and you had said that the UN had trouble not just confronting the crisis, but deciding what to call it. So if what you saw isn't a refugee crisis, then what are they saying? What is it?
They're still trying to decide. They're really, UN officials confided to us last week that they really have no historical reference point for this. It's not quite at the level where they can officially call it a refugee crisis. It's not like the Syrian crisis where you've got refugees pouring out because their lives are in danger because of war and bombardment. But by the same token, it's far more severe than just your normal economic migrant situation, you know, people fleeing an economic emergency. They really don't know yet what to call it. They've been struggling for months to figure out what it is. But as in my book, from what I saw last week, it is a refugee crisis.
And it's, you know, the UN again calling on the international community to raise about $50 million for Venezuelan refugees, but it's only gotten about a third of that. Now the UN has told WLRN that it's turning to some creative fundraising. What does that mean?
Well, they're turning more to the private sector, private citizens around the world. I think they're going to start tapping into the internet, and they're going to set up websites where private donors like you and me and private companies can start contributing, can start raising funds for these Venezuelan refugees to help fill that aid shortfall gap that we're seeing. That food stamp program was one of the first that they've been able to set up for Venezuelan refugees with what resources they've been able to raise so far. But now we can all go online, apparently, this summer and start contributing ourselves.
All right. So given there seems to be an aid shortfall, how important a role is the Venezuelan expat community here in South Florida in helping out?
It's going to play a very important role because, as I said, there is an aid shortfall gap that has to be filled. And in terms of things like food, but especially medicine, we're seeing the Venezuelan expat community here mobilize to start pivoting and sending its aid, you know, food packages, medicine packages, money, things of that nature, clothes, not into Venezuela, where really it's at risk of being confiscated by corrupt customs officials and things like that, and sending it directly to Cucuta now, where so many Venezuelan, for example, patients with bad illnesses are going because they feel that that's the only place where they can find the medication now.
And you met some Venezuelans in Cucuta who are already, they're benefiting from the diaspora here.
I met a kidney transplant patient, for example. His name was Jesus Mendoza, and he cannot find the anti-rejection medication that all transplant patients need to survive these transplant surgeries. He can't find it in Venezuela, and when he does get into Colombia, sometimes it can be too expensive for the meager earnings that Venezuelans make. Anything you make in Venezuela is automatically wiped out because of hyperinflation. So when I told him that an expat group here in Venezuela, which is called Cuatro por Venezuela, is now sending medications that include anti-rejection meds for transplant victims as donations into Cucuta, he started crying.
This crisis is causing a lot of tension, as you told me, between the Venezuelan refugees and Colombians. You said you saw a lot of that last week, but you also saw a lot of inspiring stories, too.
There is a lot of tension. Part of the reason that food stamp program was shut down last week because poor Colombians themselves are getting angry at seeing all these Venezuelan refugees get social benefits when they come in that they feel they deserve to have, not just the Venezuelans. And so you're seeing a lot of resentment, a lot of anti-immigration resentment building in Colombia, which could help the conservative candidate in this month's presidential election get elected, by the way. But as you said, I did see inspiring stories. I spent an evening with a woman who, about 15 years ago, was forced to leave Colombia by the Civil War, which was still raging there. She and her husband and kids, they owned a small dairy farm there near the border, and both the guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries wanted to essentially steal it from them, but worse than that, wanted to recruit her 13-year-old son to become a guerrilla or a paramilitary himself. They were about to abduct him. So they fled Colombia at that time and went into Venezuela to become essentially refugees, and they were welcomed, they were treated very well. And then Venezuela's economy situation went south. She and her family came back to Cucuta, Colombia, and now she runs a shelter there for Venezuelan refugees, as if, she said, to say thank you to Venezuela for the treatment she received when she herself was a refugee.
You've got next week you plan to start a three-part series, a WLRN series on this crisis called Escape from Venezuela. What most do you want people here and in the U.S. to know about the situation there?
I want our audience to know that particularly in South Florida, this is a refugee situation that we especially, because we have the largest Venezuelan expat community here in the United States. We have the largest Colombian expat community here in the United States. South Florida, more than any other place in America, has a connection to this humanitarian crisis. And I really think we need to start taking more notice of it, start contributing to alleviating it in any way we can. But I really think we need to start approaching this as our Syrian refugee crisis, as it were.
WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett just back from his trip to Colombia and following this refugee crisis from Venezuela. And you know what? We'll be tracking that series as well. Again, that series coming to WLRN called Escape from Venezuela. Tim, thanks so much, man.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, a closer look at a school in Miami that just closed. They operated for 4 years without a license, and there could be a link to a strange cult. All of that coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Rainbow Cultural Garden, an educational center for toddlers in downtown Miami, was just shut down a few weeks ago. The school was started by the wife of Mexican singer-songwriter Alejandro Sanz, Raquel Pereira, and has been in operation for 4 years. Reporting from the Miami New Times found that the school did not have a license to operate. And even more troubling, the premise behind the school is connected to the arrested cult leader, Keith Raniere. He faces charges of blackmailing female members of the group Nexium to have sex with him. Reporter Jerry Iannelli broke the story for the Miami New Times, and he joins us now. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You alerted the Florida Department of Children and Families to this school. How did it initially get to your attention?
Basically, we had been following the Nexium story for a little while, and I've just been honestly reading stories about it out of our own interest, and saw in a story out of the UK about a Rainbow Cultural Garden school in London that was under, investigation for not having a license in London, and noticed the tidbit in that story that mentioned that there were 11 schools worldwide, and one of them was in Miami. I was like, okay, well, let's take a look at this.
Let's first point out, what is this school exactly?
Yeah.
Who is it for, and where was it here in Miami?
Basically, it is a preschool children for school for young children, and they claim on their website and on their, on the windows outside, that they can teach small children as many as 7 languages at once. And they do it by sort of cycling out different caretakers that speak one of 7 languages pretty rapidly throughout the day, as far as I'm aware. The school in Miami was located in Midtown, right near the Target and the shopping center up there, which is a really popular area in town and a fairly wealthy part of town.
And I'd read that this it's not a cheap school.
No.
Thousands of dollars to send
from,
your kid.
At least from former Nexium members who have told me that it can cost as much as $10,000 a month, which factors out to about $120,000 a year. So it's not for, your low-class folks. It's a place targeted towards people with a lot of money.
So as far as you could tell, the school didn't have any license to operate at all.
Yeah, so basically, we started looking into, this Miami school is actually very close to our offices even. We were like, all right, well, let's, take a look at this. And after a couple of days of my own searching, I wasn't able to find any kind of official licensure online at all. And my next step was to just go to the Department of Children and Families and say, hey, I can't find anything. Can you help me out, basically? And I sent that a couple weeks ago, about 11 in the morning, to DCF one day. And they're like, yeah, well, we'll take a look. And then a couple hours later, it got called me back and said, actually, we'd like to thank you for bringing this to our attention. we initiated an investigation, and they've been shut down for their phrasing was improper licensure, they aren't able to tell me anything else. They say that anything else is part of an ongoing investigation, and
Does this mean they're shut down for good, or it's just indefinitely, or just until this get what I mean?
Basically, as far as I'm aware, indefinitely. I guess the school says it's not permanent and that it's part of an ongoing audit. That's the way the phrasing they have responded to me, and they, you know, stressed that the shutdown has nothing to do with any ties to the Nexium cult, and that they're, you know, sure they'll get vindicated.
All right, so before I get into the Nexium cult, you know what? I did want to skip over this, too, because you had said it, and it's one of these things is after reading it, I thought, wait a second, I've never heard of this. But is there scientific basis for teaching children at that age 7 different languages?
No, as far as I'm aware. If you speak to numerous people who were, involved in... I mean, it's an idea that came from Keith Raniere, this leader of an alleged cult. And the people who have sort of were part of the cult and then left have said, we aren't really seeing any actual language learning from these children. Some people have reported that kids are coming out not learning any languages, actually, and that the act of rapidly cycling kids through all these languages at once means they don't really grasp any of them at any real skill.
You've been trying to reach any of the parents.
Nothing so far. That's kind of what we're maybe working on next.
Do we have any idea of how many kids were enrolled in this school?
They have been extremely, extremely tight-lipped with that. If you speak again, I spoke to Frank Parlato. I guess the cult was based in Albany. And this man, Frank Parlato, was a former spokesperson for the cult who kind of turned and has now been a pretty loud spokesperson against Keith Raniere.
And now, you were on the campus. You actually did go on the campus.
Yes, I took a ride over. And, it's a fairly small facility. I walked in, and they were advertising free yoga for children on the front window, and kind of rang a doorbell and basically walked in and asked, are you related in any way to Keith Raniere? And B, I guess we haven't gotten into this yet, but B, can you talk to me about how the school is related to Alejandro Sanz, the Spanish singer? And they basically told me this is a franchise and we can't, I spoke to basically someone at the desk and I heard children in the background playing, so I knew there were kids there at the time, but it was a nice place. I mean, it was shiny and clean and everything else, but... they just basically took a card and said, we can't help you.
All right. So let's talk about, first of all, who opened this school?
Yes,
we go back to, before we get to the cult, before we get to Raniere, because, there's so many players involved in this. Mm-hmm. But so again, the school was started by the wife of Mexican singer Alejandro Sanz, mm-hmm. Raquel Pereira.
Yes.
I mean, what, she owns it, she started it. How many people are involved besides her?
A couple years ago did sort of a media tour, basically bragging that she was opening this school in Midtown, and she was on Univision and all over the Spanish press and in Spain, and saying, oh, well, we've discovered this wonderful new way to teach children all these languages at once. And I guess there's one Univision clip that she even thanks Keith Raniere for coming up with the idea. And she actually, I guess according to the state documents, she signed as the owner in 2016, and they've never, I've reached out to them numerous, numerous times, and they've chosen not to respond. So I don't actually know what motivated her to open the school.
So we've seen online, only these online connections.
Yes.
So I don't know if there's a connection, but obviously...
Well, the school has acknowledged there is... The idea came from Keith Raniere. They directly told me that. Yeah.
Okay. Do we know she's connected to him in any way? She's just saying he's great.
This is kind of the million-dollar question, which I would love Alejandro Sanz and or his wife to answer publicly, especially since he himself has also gone around in the media promoting the school and this idea. But they have chosen to be utterly radio silent about it.
Briefly describe to us, what is this Nexium cult? Who is Keith Raniere?
Yeah. So he is a former multi-level marketing executive from Albany, New York, who started this group called Nexium in the 90s, which was just kind of your garden variety self-help organization, teaching classes of, how to best empower yourself and find your inner potential and all this sort of standard business motivation stuff. But there have been allegations since going on a decade that it had sort of morphed into a cult. And, you know, Albany, I guess, is sort of a small town. And if you read through the old Albany Times Union newspaper clips, you know, there were allegations going back to 2003 that he had this sort of weird cult of personality around him. But it didn't really kind of explode until a New York Times story in October of 17, when a bunch of former cult members said that Ranieri was blackmailing women, forcing people to have sex with him, forcing women into sex slavery.
He was branding women?
And branding them with hot irons with his initials, KR. There are multiple photos of this on the internet if you care to look. But he was quite literally, he had started, according to, a federal indictment, they say he had started this kind of inner group within NXIVM called DOS, or also known as the Vow. And in this group, similar to his former world as in multi-level marketing, there was sort of a pyramid of alleged sex slaves, and he sat atop and called himself the Vanguard, and then underneath him, women pledged sort of sexual fealty to him and were branded with his initials sort of on their pelvic area. This is all according to the New York Times story and a federal indictment. And then those slaves had slaves underneath them, and so on and so forth.
He was arrested recently.
Yeah, he was, after this New York Times story came out in 2017, it seems like he fled the country, maybe got wind that, things were probably going south for him pretty rapidly. So he flees, and the FBI winds up apprehending him outside of Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, living on a $10,000 a month estate with some other NXIVM members. He is now charged with sex trafficking. And the feds also allege that he has had sex with, this is in a federal indictment, alleged that he has had sex with girls as young as 12.
And you spoke again with somebody who had a connection with NXIVM.
Yes.
And at what level was this person?
I mean, he was the former spokesperson for the cult. He has been involved, in one of the tactics the cult has used to sort of silence critics over the time is they are backed by, Ranieri has been backed by these two women named Clara and Sarah Bronfman, who are the heirs to the Seagram's liquor fortune. And that's sort of where Ranieri's been getting most of his money throughout most of this time. And one of the Bronfman's tactics is to kind of attack and sue critics. And so this Frank Perlotto has been sort of much in the same way that Scientology, this is going clear, and all these other documentaries are often based on former members speaking out, Perlotto in the same way.
So what do we know, again, of the link between NXIVM, Keith Ranieri, and this school here in Miami?
So what we know is that Ranieri himself founded the original branch in 2006 in Albany, New York. And the idea absolutely came from him. The school in Miami has said and has told me personally that the idea came from him. The school in Miami now claims they have no connection to him. If you speak to the former cult member I spoke to, and then if you look at other clips in the press, a lot of people allege that Ranieri himself was basically, until the day he was arrested, was directly involved in the whole school chain. People have said that it was maybe a way to sort of suck money out of wealthy members who were already kind of enamored with Ranieri, and he could basically say, oh, send your kids here, give me $10,000 a month and I'll teach them to speak every language in the world. And there is also, if you look, there is an unbelievable amount of overlap between high-level NXIVM members and high-level Rainbow Cultural Garden members. And many, in the Los Angeles NXIVM community also worked in the Rainbow Cultural Garden. Same thing is true about Albany. Same thing is true about the location in Monterrey, Mexico.
We're going to keep an eye on to see if you get a hold of any of these parents and talk to them. Or, again, if you happen to talk to, Mr. Sands or Miss Mrs. Pereira. Again, talking with Miami New Times reporter Jerry Iannelli about this story that broke, again, about the closing of this school here in Miami, the Rainbow Cultural Garden, and its ties to this cult, NXIVM. Very strange story. Not to say it's one of those Florida stories, but it just sounds like it. Jerry, a pleasure. We'll have you back, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, we are going to have a conversation with this year's Pulitzer Prize winner in history, a story about the Gulf of Mexico. That's next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, we on the east coast of Florida may not talk much about the Gulf of Mexico, really not that often. It's on the other side of the state, and yet we depend so much on that body of water for fishing and oil, and, well, it holds a really important role in our history. And that history is beautifully spelled out in the new book, The Gulf, by Jack Davis. That is the 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner for history. Well, I actually can't say it's new. It was last year. Davis is a professor of history and sustainability studies at the University of Florida, and he joins us now from the studios of WUFT in Gainesville. Professor Davis, a pleasure to have you.
A pleasure to be here.
And by the way, congratulations on the Pulitzer. Where were you? When did you find out?
I was in the middle of a meeting in my office on campus with a graduate student, my phone started ringing off the hook. My cell phone started ringing. Texts are pinging, and it's becoming very disruptive. And so I had to interrupt our meeting and excuse myself to ensure there wasn't an emergency. And then I saw a text from my editor that said I had won the Pulitzer Prize.
That's a good distraction to have for the day. Yes. If you're going to be pulled out of a meeting for anything. So how did this project begin? When did you, first of all, you're covering hundreds of years of history here. It is not a small endeavor by any means, but when did it begin and how?
Well, it began, I can actually trace it to my childhood, growing up on the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, then I had no idea I'd be writing this book. But my previous book was a biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and which was published in 2009. So I was searching around for another book to write, another topic to explore. And because I had this intimate connection, virtually lifelong connection with the Gulf of Mexico, it seemed like the ideal subject for me. Nobody had written the history. And then the oil spill happened. And that really gave me a clear objective of how to approach this history. And one was not to write a book about the oil spill, but to restore the identity of the Gulf of Mexico, because I believe that that oil spill, that 87-day nightmare that we all experienced in the summer of 2010, robbed the Gulf of its true identity. And so I wanted my readers to know that the Gulf of Mexico is more than this oil sump, more than just a vacation spot, that it has this rich and wonderful history that's part of the larger American historical narrative.
And you're talking about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of 2010.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so you know what, before I want to dig in a little bit to some of the different, because again, you're covering this big, massive span of time for this book, but you know, I had to go back and think to myself, what do I know about the Gulf of Mexico? And the first question that pops to mind is, wait a minute, why do they call it the Gulf of Mexico? Because who really owns it? Why is it called the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, it had a number of different names, and for a few hundred years, the Gulf of Mexico was really a Spanish sea. And at one point, it was called the Spanish Sea. And of course, Spain possessed Mexico. And it was logical before the United States came along to for the Spanish to name the sea. And I call it an American sea because, or the making of an American sea, because the since the Louisiana Purchase, the United States has slowly gained control over the Gulf of Mexico. And I shouldn't say slowly, but pretty rapidly throughout the 19th century.
All right. You probably remember this. I found this because I didn't know, but there was a few years back, there was an idea brought up by Democratic Representative Stephen Holland. He had proposed to rename it Gulf of America. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. Well, it doesn't really begin with him. You can go back to Thomas Jefferson. And when he finalized, he sought the Louisiana Purchase, not primarily for the land out west, but for control over the Mississippi River. And whatever country had control of that river really had control of commerce through the upper North America and the Gulf of Mexico. And he paid more for New Orleans than he did the rest of the territory. But having control of the Gulf of Mexico was part of his motivation. And after that acquisition, which brought us our first Gulf front real estate, he encouraged subsequent presidents to go after Cuba. He believed that it was rightfully American. And many in Congress believe that the Gulf of Mexico was rightfully an American sea.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about that too, but I'm going to hold off on that one, on the Cuba question, just a minute. Let's do this. We think about Florida, and we think about the Gulf of Mexico. You call it the Spanish Sea. It was known as the Spanish Sea, but it goes back to this history of Florida. And what we remember being taught in school, obviously we think of Ponce de Leon and some of the other, other famous conquistadors and Spanish gentlemen that came over here to the New World. When we talk about some of those first settlers and the conquistadors and so forth, I mean, they weren't looking for Florida. Once they'd already settled in, of course, in Cuba and parts of the Caribbean, they wanted to trek to Mexico. But they didn't get there, not right away. They found the Gulf. They found the Gulf states and the Gulf coasts. I mean, how did that happen? What did they understand about the Gulf itself and navigating it?
Well, during the conquistador period, or at least the early period, they didn't know much about the Gulf of Mexico, and not really until the 1520s did somebody come up with a crude map, and so it was very easy. I mean, navigation was primarily by the stars and by your gut. And so it was easy to get lost even in a place like the Gulf of Mexico. And you're referring to one expedition led by Panfilo de Narvaez, who was trying to get to Mexico, and he ended up in Tampa by accident and believed he had initially believed that he had actually arrived in Mexico. But ended up exploring the rest of the Gulf, which was not his intention, because it ultimately led to his death and hundreds of his men over an 8-year period.
And then that leads to other gentlemen who followed him. Of course, one of the most famous ones, Hernando de Soto. He actually took a pretty large group of people and an army. Through some of the same areas that his predecessors had reached, but then he took it even further, and he went through some of these Gulf states, and through Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and so forth. And his name is very famous in a lot of places. You'll see things named after him. But what role did he play in really helping European settlers understand the Gulf?
Virtually nothing. And... What his greatest contribution? It was a failed, miserably failed 4-year expedition that cost him his life, what he contributed to Spanish exploration was the spread of European diseases throughout the Gulf states, and the die-off of hundreds, if not thousands, thousands of native peoples. Who had no immunities to these European diseases, such as smallpox and measles. And so those who followed encountered less resistance from the indigenous peoles. Before Soto, the Gulf natives were staunch resistors. They were not willing to tolerate any of these European intruders.
Again, I'm talking with Jack Davis. He is the 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner for history for his book, The Gulf. Again, a very extensive look at the history of the Gulf of Mexico and its role in shaping U.S. history. You talked a little while ago about the Louisiana Purchase, and so the country expands. Now, there were people, as you said, who believed that beyond just taking Florida from, getting Florida from the Spanish, that they should go even beyond that and take Cuba and get Cuba into U.S. Into its territory as part of the manifest destiny. Why did they feel Cuba was that important, and why didn't it happen?
Well, Cuba was important to them because it's really the gateway into the Gulf of Mexico, and it would be a good spot for the American strategic spot for the Americans to. Establish themselves to prevent any enemies or unwanted forces from coming into the Gulf of Mexico. And they, Andrew Jackson, after he more or less wrested Florida away from the Spanish in the 1810s, told Washington, give me the money, the men and the money, and I'll take Cuba too. Well, the men and the money were not forthcoming, but the idea lingered for some time. And eventually the United States offered to buy Cuba from Spain. But Cuba was always an important possession to Spain. It paid for itself. It was important for the as a way station for the transportation of gold and silver from Mexico. And Spain had no intention, had no desire, and more or less told the Americans that you can take your offer and you know, do you know what with it. And of course, the Americans were insulted by that. And many in Congress said, "Oh, this is we've been jilted, we've been insulted. It's a slap in the face. We need to go down and seize Cuba." But that wouldn't happen for about another 70, 80 years.
As you point out throughout the book, one of the things, too, about the Gulf of Mexico is that it's a treacherous place and has been for not just the Spaniards, but for Americans. At least the entry into New Orleans, not the best place for the Confederacy, even though they thought it was a pretty safe area from attack. And, of course, we've seen from all the hurricanes over the last few centuries, and really actually all going back to the Spaniards, it hasn't been the friendliest of places for maritime. Why do we continue then to expand development along the Gulf of Mexico, even though the history has shown us it's kind of a dangerous place?
Well, you're absolutely right. It is kind of a dangerous place. It was a very difficult place to map. The U.S. Coastal Survey, it was desperate to try to find a clear line between land and water, and that was virtually impossible because the coast is always changing, and of course it's more or less a hurricane alley, storm ridden place, and it's not particularly wise to live on the water. And for many years, the Americans stayed away from the water, except for the fishing industry. And but there are certain incentives that have come with these storms that have wiped out communities, at least in the modern period in the 20th century, is that after a big hurricane levels a particular part of the Gulf of Mexico, the real estate prices drop significantly, and this draws investors and developers in, and of course the local officials are eager to get their economy back up and running, and so they offer a lot of concessions to these developers, and suddenly there's a building boom. And Americans, unfortunately, have short historical memory. We know that in Florida, in particular. And so a hurricane that happened a few years ago is forgotten, and development and real estate purchases and soaring land prices often follow.
Is there any body of water that's comparable to the importance of a nation as the Gulf of Mexico has been to the U.S.?
I don't think so, because we share the Atlantic Ocean with some 43 other countries. And as I say in the book, the Pacific Ocean is more or less a hemisphere in itself. And the Gulf fishery is one of the richest fisheries in the nation, born from the estuarine environment of the Gulf of Mexico, which is one of the richest in the world. It's a fishery that outperforms the entire East Coast fishery from New England on down to South Florida in many years, so I think it's hard to beat the Gulf of Mexico as in its importance as a sea to the United States.
Again, Jack Davis is a professor of history and sustainability studies at the University of Florida and the 2018 Pulitzer Prize winner for history for his book, The Gulf. He joined us from the studios of WUFT in Gainesville. Professor Davis, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, the sounds of the Harlem Quartet. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you're listening to Take the A-Train, composed by Billy Strayhorn and performed by the legendary Duke Ellington Orchestra. This song is one of several jazz standards performed by the Harlem Quartet with their own unique twist. Well, the Grammy-winning string ensemble has been performing for a dozen years in concert halls, schools, and even the White House. Their mission is to diversify the audience listening to classical music, often by playing in coffee shops and bars and blending jazz into their concerts. They have a number of performances in West Palm Beach this week at the Blind Monk, the Bright Line, and the Rosarian Academy. Felix Umansky with the Harlem Quartet joins us from the studios of WXEL. Also with him is the executive and artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Palm Beach County. Joining us, Michael Finn. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so you know what? Each member of the Harlem Quartet comes into the world of classical music from unique cultural backgrounds. Felix, talk about your early exposure to classical music.
Well, I grew up in a household of classical musicians. My mother is a cellist and my father is a violinist, and they are both still performing professionally. And so I always grew up with the sounds of classical music. And it was very early on that I knew I wanted to be a musician. When I was 5 years old, my parents decided to start me on the violin. And for one reason or another, the violin and I did not get along. So at the age of seven, I switched to the cello. And it was one of those sensations I still remember, that even though I couldn't make a decent sound from day one or maybe even day 100, there was something about the sound of the cello that just really resonated with me. And perhaps it's because to me it imitates the sound of the human voice so closely, but I knew this was the instrument for me.
Well, that sounds like me and every instrument, so that's okay. Was the Harlem name chosen as an ode to the neighborhood's jazz greats?
It was, and it was also bestowed upon the quartet, because in the early years, the quartet actually, even before the early years, day one, the group was put together by an organization in Detroit, Michigan, called the Sphinx Organization. And Sphinx had received a grant from Target and some other organizations to sponsor a string quartet to go into every single school in Harlem and present classical music to kids of all ages. And so the Harlem Quartet was put together as a result. And what Sphinx did is they sponsor a competition for string players every single year, and they still do to this day. And at that point, this was in 2006, they contacted the original four members of the quartet, who happened to be first prize winners of that competition in the past. And they said, how would you like to do this creative project? And everybody said, sure, we'd love to. And everybody moved to Harlem. We had a rehearsal space and a studio in Harlem, and we spent quite a while going to every single school presenting music to these students.
And it's interesting you talk about going to schools, because you know accessibility is one of the critical barriers to new classical music listeners, for, whether it's a financial perspective or a taste perspective. How have these performances in the local schools addressed that barrier?
Well, that's such an interesting question. And yes, you're absolutely right. These schools, particularly the ones in Harlem that the quartet was going to, depending on which subway line you take, you are only one stop away from Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall. And for various reasons, like you just stated, financial or cultural or otherwise, these people wouldn't venture into these other musical locations. And so our mission continues to this day to be, well, if you won't come to us in our environment, we'll gladly come to you. And we found that the kids really, well, number one, we always said that these students are some of the most honest audiences that we'll ever play for. And they ask some of the most profound questions afterwards. And they make up stories for us about how music makes them feel. And then fast forward, when we play on a main series in a particular town after we've done some outreach in the local community, a lot of these students will come with their parents, and we have many concert presenters who come up to us afterwards so excited, not only by the performance, but also that they saw so many new faces in their audiences for the first time.
Michael Finn, I want to ask that same question to you. Is it, again, this idea of accessibility to classical music, and how do we reach audiences that, you know, they're not looking for it right away?
Yeah, part of our mission at the Chamber Music Society is to go into schools. So every group that we bring into Palm Beach or West Palm Beach or Boca, the artist will stay an extra day or two, and we'll go to as many schools as we can go to. This is our first full-fledged residency. The quartet, Harlem Quartet, is in town for 5 days. We're going to multiple schools. Yesterday we played a pop-up concert at the Brightline Station in West Palm for about 200 people. Tonight is a public performance. Then we have 2 days of school concerts. And finally we end at the Blind Monk with a little bit of chamber music and a little bit of wine tasting. Again, just trying to get out into the community. It's all about the exposure.
You know, the other thing, too, is this. Florida right now is facing a critical funding shortage in arts programming this coming year. The latest budget slashed 90% of the money appropriated for arts and cultural programming for the state. I mean, Michael, I mean, you're concerned with that. How do you overcome that barrier?
I'm very fortunate that we operate in Palm Beach County. We have a wonderful board of directors, and we have an incredible list of subscribers and benefactors. So we're basically working with private monies. We get a little bit of help from the county, but we're also a very young organization. So we do what we can with the goodwill of the citizens of Palm Beach County.
And Felix, you know, I mean, look, every artist I talk to, and we've already seen the studies that, you know, the role that arts education can play at a young age in helping develop somebody. But, you know, you hear something like that. How do you overcome that?
Well, the best thing I could say is that we keep doing what we are doing. And arts education, I believe, goes even beyond the arts. I mean, these students that we perform for, we ultimately aren't trying to convince every single one of them to become a professional musician. I mean, if they want to, fantastic. But the broader mission is not only to show people that, oh, everyone can play classical music as long as you work very hard, and if you have talent, that helps as well. But as a string quartet, we hope to also convey not only this wonderful music to them, but we work together like a team, obviously, and a lot of students will say that to us. They said, oh, you work together like a team, or you seem to play like the Miami Heat. You guys are just like a sports team in how you work together. And, you know, this is everywhere we go. And so our broader mission, if somebody isn't going to become a professional musician, at least they might grow up to appreciate and support the arts. But also we hope that they, in watching us do what we do live, can appreciate what it's like to just be able to relate to one another, even if you're not, you know, able to speak to them, which we cannot do when we play. We communicate through our instruments, but we are still able to have a respectful, civil conversation with one another using our art form. And that's what we hope to convey to these students, that they just need to be able to relate to all human beings and be able to be respectful and good to one another.
All right, Felix, when you perform at the Rosarian Academy or at the Blind Monk on Thursday, what are you hoping to see from your audience? What indication will you have that you achieved your goal?
Well, we're hoping to see that everyone's just having a good time. It's very easy for us to feed off of the audience. And obviously, the more intimate the space, such as the Blind Monk, the easier it will be. And of course, you know, if a little wine is involved, that always helps. But even in these big concert halls, we can definitely feed off of the audience experience. And one of the reasons we program our concerts the way we do, with not just standard classical repertoire, but also jazz and Latin tunes, is we want to be able to show the audience members that this music of all genres and styles really relates to one another. And when people begin to realize that, then they are able to relax even more and have an even better time, hopefully.
Well, Felix Omansky is with the Harlem Quartet, and again, we also heard from executive and artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Palm Beach, Michael Finn. Felix, Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have more information on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial, if you want to learn more about the Harlem Quartet's performances coming up in Palm Beach County. Well, that's the show for today, Monday, May 7th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.